The Takeaway is supported by TechServe, an Apple Premier partner. TechServe has been supporting New Yorkers for 29 years with Mac repairs and upgrades, including data recovery, liquid damage, hard drive issues, general troubleshooting, and more. TechServe.com. And An American in Paris, the new Tony Award-winning musical that brings the magic and romance of Paris into perfect harmony with the unforgettable songs of George and Ira Gershwin, winner of more awards than any other musical of the year. Tickets at AmericanInParisBroadway.com.
God bless the great state of Wisconsin.
I don't know if the audience here knows it. I don't see any TVs here, but it has been projected by, I think, all of the networks that we won in Wisconsin.
Tonight is a turning point. It is a rallying cry. It is a call from the hardworking men and women of Wisconsin to the people of America. We have a choice, a real choice.
With our victory tonight in Wisconsin, we have now won 7 out of 8 of the last caucuses and primaries.
Either before Cleveland or at the convention in Cleveland, together we will win a majority of the delegates, and together we will beat Hillary Clinton in November.
You know, whatever happens from this point on, the 2016 political race begins today. This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. Thanks so much for listening. In the post-war period, American presidential politics have moved away, slowly but surely, from party leadership-driven, opaque backroom procedures and deal-making, and towards the openness of the primary process. We cover it every 4 years. Voters decide candidates, and those choices get ratified at conventions, where decisions are largely scripted, controversy is avoided, and selling the candidates is the mission of the, let's face it, boring convention. Well, the Wisconsin primary this year seems to have revealed the limit to which voters are capable of choosing candidates in either party in 2016. First, the GOP. Ted Cruz beat frontrunner Donald Trump by 13 points. He won among women and men and in urban areas of Milwaukee, Green Bay, and Madison. In Donald Trump's view, the backroom dealing at the convention has already begun to take him down, even though he leads in delegates by far. This is what he said about Ted Cruz. Ted Cruz is worse than a puppet. He is a Trojan horse being used by the party bosses attempting to steal the nomination from Mr. Trump. Ohio Governor John Kasich, formerly dubbed the Trojan horse, won 0 delegates with 14% of the vote. A disputed convention where the delegates themselves have the power to choose these candidates or any other compromise option is now likely for the Republicans. Less likely as a nominee, though, but still in play, Wisconsinites have given Vermont Senator Bernie Sanders a solid win on the Democratic side, winning 45 delegates to Hillary Clinton's 31. We'll talk about the implications of that for the Democrats in just a moment, but to tackle the identity conundrum that is now the Republican Party, we turn to David Frum, senior editor of The Atlantic and chairman of the Policy Exchange from 2001 to 2002. He was a speechwriter for President George W. Bush. Frum says this is suddenly Republican rugby between two groups who have been more politely at odds for nearly a generation.
Basically, you have a party elite which wants more immigration, big tax cuts, and an activist foreign policy. And you have a party base that wants to protect entitlements, less immigration, and a less activist foreign policy. Up to this point, the elite has largely gotten its way. But in 2016, the party base finally got an opportunity with this spectacular Trump candidacy to register a protest.
You know, one could say that about the Democratic Party, but it seems like the older Democrats are thinking progressive. The very younger Democrats are thinking progressive. There are party identities that are associated with specific policies, but then there's just this angry group that, you know, it's not necessarily associated with any particular policy. And that is what seems to be in flux in this political season.
Well, is that a surprise? I mean, we have now had 6 years of statistical economic recovery. The American economy today is bigger than it was in 2007. Total output is higher than it was in 2007. And if you look at the figures in the aggregate, the country's better off than it was at the last economic peak. And yet, the large majority of Americans, I'd venture probably about two-thirds, are worse off than they were in 2007. And they have seen all the gains of this economic expansion captured by a relative few. And by the way, not those few who are capturing it, you know, aren't just the Koch brothers. There are a lot of people in the Democratic coalition who are also very satisfied, successful winners from this new era of, you know, free trade and massive migration and a globalized economy. But in both parties, there are lots of people who have not been winners. And that's who we're hearing from. And I think that's maybe the fundamental question on the ballot in 2016, which is how do you make the new economy of the United States work for enough people, more people, so that you don't have these eruptions of dissatisfaction?
Yeah, I take your point there, but statistically, it seems like it's so incremental. I mean, in past years, you know, the question of the Iran-Iraq war was making people very angry. The economic downturn of 2008 was a catastrophe, and then the months that succeeded it were even worse. You know, you had much worse conditions and specific issues to be angry about. That motivated the parties. I'm just surprised that there's so much anger, and yet the incremental dissatisfaction that individuals might be feeling seems relatively abstract.
I don't think it's surprising that they are more pessimistic and more anxious and more angry in 2016 than they were in 2012, when they could credibly hope, I haven't tasted it yet, but it's coming my way. In 2016, it's plain, it's not coming your way. If you haven't tasted it yet, it's not coming your way. And meanwhile, and this is where the immigration issue is so important, that we have four people on the Republican side, the sense of mass displacement, a cultural change that is coming that is going to make you and people like you less central to the country. And we have leaders all the time saying, hey, buddy, you used to be the majority. You're not anymore. Tough nuts to you. That, you know, we all celebrate that you are about to be you're about to have a loss of political power as well as economic security.
Who then is the party of the angry whites? Is it going to be the Republicans or is it going to be the Democrats?
The Democrats are not going to be the party of the angry whites. They're going to be the party of upmarket whites and minorities. If you are an ordinary American, as most of us are, your Americanness is one of the most prized possessions you've got. And when you feel like, hey, that the terms of that are being arbitrarily changed by powerful outside forces against the law, against my vote, you feel pretty alienated and disenfranchised and angry.
David Frum, senior editor at The Atlantic and chairman of Policy Exchange. From 2001 to 2002, he was a speechwriter for President George W. Bush. So what party are the Democrats becoming? The non-white, non-Trump, liberalish Hoosits? Angry radical progressives ready to throw off the Clinton elites? Or are the Democrats the same old grumpy coalition of center-left whites, African-Americans, and Latinos that propelled Barack Obama into office twice, but without a candidate they can all agree upon in 2016? Bernie Sanders got a solid victory in Wisconsin, which at the very least will turn the New York primary into a favorite son versus favorite daughter contest. The Brooklyn-born Vermont senator facing the Illinois-born former New York senator. Barbara Lawton, former lieutenant governor of Wisconsin, joins us. Is the party of Bernie Sanders the Democrats, or is it the party of Hillary Clinton right now? Barbara, what would you say?
It's evolving, and it's very interesting. You may have heard Hillary Clinton say, kind of assert that I have been a Democrat for a long time, and I'm raising money for the Democratic Party, et cetera, et cetera. And what you see is that, yes, she feels very much like and represents the establishment Democratic Party. And Bernie is kind of bringing a whole new storm to that party. And especially when you look at that young population, the studies tell us, and the individuals will reassert it, that these millennials are not partisan by nature. So the real The interesting question that we face is Bernie is, I mean, spirits are rising and people are flocking to this. Will the Democratic Party be smart enough to capture that? And I think it's really important.
Can Hillary be the nominee in a convention that doesn't offend all of these Bernie Sanders neo-Democrats that you've talked about, as well as the traditional progressives who were likely to support Bernie anyway?
Of course, I think she can be, but I think that there's some work that needs to be done between now and then. When you're a candidate, you can't really allow yourself or indulge yourself in irritation like she did the other day with the Greenpeace activist and said to a journalist later, you know, I feel sorry for these young people who don't do their own research. And I thought, ooh, let's not. These young people are super savvy on research. And these kids pierce right through that. And they want to hear the truth. But they're not the only swath of the population that's interested in that. You can see it in other groups. And you can see it on the right, where there's this curious perception that Donald Trump only speaks the truth.
Well, Barbara Lawton, Hillary Clinton is someone you voted for and supported in 2008. She's your generation. This is an issue of feminism and, women taking control in politics. How could you possibly abandon that?
Because when I was Hillary Clinton's first Midwest co-chair and first statewide endorser in the Midwest, I wanted to come in early. I thought she was the most progressive candidate. And it was a rather clear choice. If Bernie Sanders, if I felt that he didn't get the issues that define my life as a woman right to his DNA, it would be different. But he does.
Are they the ticket, Sanders, Clinton?
You mean president, vice president?
There you go.
I would tell you, as a woman who served 8 years as lieutenant governor, that was my last time as best supporting actress. I don't think that's Hillary Clinton's position.
Yeah, I think you're probably right on that one. Barbara Lawton, thank you so much. It's great to talk to you.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Barbara Lawton, former lieutenant governor of Wisconsin.
You're listening to The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI Public Radio International in collaboration with The New York Times and WGBH Boston Public Radio.
The construction cranes over Miami, Florida always say something's going on. The boom and bust cycles everywhere else in America don't really apply in Miami. And the Panama Papers leaks have provided an answer to the question of why and who was investing in luxury condos and high-rises in Miami when the ownership of some of the developments over the past decade were at best sketchy companies loaded with invisible partners. 200 countries and territories from Iceland to India have been implicated in the Panama Papers, and in the U.S., Miami has come in for some special scrutiny. Nicholas Nahamis is a reporter for the Miami Herald. He's been tracing how his city is involved in the international money laundering world for months as part of the Panama Papers investigating team.
People in Miami have been talking about the condo market being propped up by illicit money since, you know, the 70s and 80s, the cocaine cowboy days. But this is really the first, you know, major example of case after case of people accused of corruption buying real estate in Miami with cash. And, the federal government is aware of this and last month started tracking shell companies like these buying luxury real estate in Miami and Manhattan. And the market is already cooling off for a variety of economic reasons, but also maybe because people are scared of the feds finding out what they're up to.
Do you have a sense of the kind of transaction that all of a sudden alerted the feds and what was going on before the feds paid any attention? I mean, you just put the money down and you've got your penthouse?
Yeah, there are no banks involved. We don't really see briefcases full of cash anymore. It's more like financial instruments such as cashier's checks, money orders. And I think the case that really alerted people to what was happening was an alleged drug lord, Alvaro Lopez Tardon of the so-called Los Miami gang, who bought, I think, more than 10 condos, a fleet of luxury cars, and was sentenced to 150 years in federal prison for money laundering.
How much is Brazil conceivably involved in this. The Brazil-Miami connection is, again, well known.
Brazil is one of the top buyers of Miami real estate, despite their economy. And in fact, the biggest name that we found in Miami was a real estate developer and politician in Brazil called Paulo Octavio, who secretly bought a $3 million waterfront condo in Miami a few months after being accused of corruption and having to resign as the governor of Brasilia.
In this particular case, this money comes out of Brazil, and at no point are taxes paid, not even sales tax in Florida?
There would be taxes paid, but they could be paid through a shell company, so no one would really know who is behind that company.
And the shell company pays the tax, but you don't lose any money. It all just comes to you. The company is set up to basically take all the losses, and you get all the cash.
Yeah, it's a limited liability company. In a lot of instances, it's owned by an offshore company. Many of them are based in the British Virgin Islands, which is a popular tax and offshore haven.
And is the available cash out of Mossack Fonseca used in the arms trade at all? You've mentioned drugs, you've mentioned real estate and money laundering to avoid taxes.
Yes, we in Miami actually have a story coming about a pretty well-known case locally of three young guys who managed to win hundreds of millions of dollars in arms contracts from the Pentagon, but it seems may have been a front for a Swiss arms dealer on a government watch list who was using an offshore company to do business with them. This is actually the subject of a new movie coming out in August starring Jonah Hill.
We're talking to Nicholas Nahamis, reporter at the Miami Herald. This is The Takeaway. So the movie and the revelations come out at the same time.
Yeah, it's funny how I guess art imitates life sometimes.
You just can't make this stuff up. Can you describe the systematic way in which this was leaked? I mean, leak is not really the right term to use in this essentially collaboration between insiders and journalists around the world.
Yeah, this was a massive undertaking. Nearly 400 journalists around the world. We communicated to analyze these files on a tool that was kind of similar to a private Facebook. And it was really amazing to be able to work with colleagues in Brazil, Italy, and Argentina, because I'd say, you know, oh, I found this guy in the files buying a condo. He seems pretty interesting. And my Brazilian colleagues would say, oh, my God, that's huge. You don't know who that is. And then they'd help me figure out what was really going on.
Do you think this is Greenwald and Company or the same folks that enabled Snowden?
The leaker?
Yeah.
You know, I really have no idea. The German newspaper that got the leak, Süddeutsche Zeitung, the leaker is a confidential source for them. It appears maybe to have come from inside the firm, but otherwise, beyond that, I really don't know.
Fascinating stuff. I guess this is going to take up the rest of your year, huh, Nicholas?
This is just beginning, and we have a lot more digging to do. I mean, there are 11.5 million files and so many unexplored angles. I would say to anyone in Miami who's listening, if you have an offshore, better tell us now because we may find out very soon.
Nicholas Nahamis is a reporter at the Miami Herald. Thanks so much, Nick.
Thank you.
Ted Cruz's victory last night in Wisconsin will make it more likely that Donald Trump will go to the GOP convention short of the 1,237 delegates needed to secure the nomination on a first ballot. So delegates could come up with a compromise candidate. And could that candidate be another compromise candidate, the compromise candidate for House Speaker Paul Ryan? Takeaway Washington correspondent Todd Zwillick on the GOP maneuverings towards a contested convention.
The GOP convention is more than 3 months away, but maneuvering on whatever's next has already started. Ted Cruz's forces are busy sweeping up delegates a few at a time, sometimes using obscure rules at state conventions. And in Washington, D.C., there's another game being played, and this one involves someone who's not at all obscure.
You know, look, Donald Trump excites a lot of enthusiasm. He also excites a lot of anger within the Republican Party and outside of the Republican Party, and a fresh face might be the thing that could give us a chance to turn this election and win in November against Hillary.
That's Karl Rove just the other day on the Hugh Hewitt radio show. Now, he didn't mention any names, but unnamed Republicans the very next day took to the Washington Insider political press to make sure that everyone knew that fresh face was a code word for Speaker Paul Ryan. Why? Because Rove and others know that if no one wins on the first ballot in Cleveland, the GOP convention could be chaos. Neither Cruz nor Trump, both hated by the party establishment, can get a majority. Someone from outside could swoop in, unify the warring factions, and emerge the nominee. Now, the party bigwigs may want Paul Ryan, but what does Paul Ryan have to say about all this? Well, it's confusing. Here he is on Monday on that very same Hugh Hewitt radio show.
So you're not the fresh face that Karl Rove was talking about?
No, I'm not the fresh face. I'm not that person. I'd like to think my face is somewhat fresh, but I'm not for this conversation. I think you need to run for president if you're going to be president. I'm not running for president, so period, end of story.
Ryan himself muddied the waters when he gave an unprompted and in some ways puzzling speech to a group of Capitol Hill interns a few weeks ago on the state of the American political scene.
Politics can be a battle of ideas, not a battle of insults. It can be about solutions. This is the system our founders envisioned. It's messy. It's complicated. It is infuriating at times, but it's a beautiful thing, too.
It was high-minded, soul of the conservative GOP kind of stuff. I was there. Ryan was criticizing Donald Trump without naming him and reminding people that the GOP still has a reputation and a history worth preserving. I went and spoke with political columnist Jonathan Chait of New York Magazine. Chait says that to him, it's clear. Paul Ryan is running for president.
What Paul Ryan is doing is positioning himself so that if the Republican convention is deadlocked, the party can turn to him and give him its nomination, and then he can rescue the party from the desperate straits in which it now finds itself.
I asked South Dakota Senator and GOP number 3 John Thune, is Paul Ryan running for president?
Not that I'm aware of, no. I haven't seen any evidence or indication that Paul Ryan, notwithstanding a lot of interest in him being willing to entertain that idea.
In fact, at least 3 times, maybe more, Ryan himself has said he's not interested in that nomination. And despite all the denials, there's one thing that Paul Ryan hasn't done, the Sherman-esque denial, the LBJ denial. If nominated, I will not accept. If elected, I will not serve. Jonathan Chait of New York Magazine.
If he wanted to stop being asked, would you like the convention nomination? All he would have to say is, I won't accept it. But he hasn't said that. So to me, that indicates that he's leaving the door open for what is clearly not a likely possibility, but is also on the table.
No one knows yet how many delegates Donald Trump will have heading into Cleveland in July, or what could happen on the convention floor if delegates start to shift between candidates. And even if party leaders are keen on arranging a Paul Ryan savior candidacy, like the one he used to get the speaker's gavel, there's no guarantee it would work. But I talked with one known political operative here in town, a guy named Ron Bongean. He was communications director and a strategist for leaders like Speaker Denny Hastert and Majority Leader Trent Lott. He said, and I'm quoting, Paul Ryan is in a perfect position because he's viewed as the savior of the GOP, and a draft Paul Ryan movement could kick into action on the convention floor right after the first ballot. All Paul Ryan has to do now is keep saying he doesn't want the nomination, deliver visionary speeches, and keep a high visibility. This is Todd Zwillick in Washington.
The general expectation is the unemployment rate will be unchanged at 4.9%.
Bosses are adding a lot of jobs, 215,000.
Central tendency of the inflation is 1.5 to 1.6%.
6.3% in March.
Slow growth is coming from slow productivity growth. You know, output per worker has not been growing quickly.
Enough is enough.
Bring back booming economic growth.
The defining economic challenge of our time is clear. Clear.
Oh, really?
This week, another view of the hard-to-decipher global economy. We've looked at oil prices this week and China already. But the real driver of economic instability for much of this decade has already been what's been going on in Europe. Our series, The 2016 Economic Fog, Finding a Way Forward, concludes that Europe is a crucial domain as ever before. Heidi Krebo-Redeker is a senior fellow at the Council on Foreign Relations and CEO of International Capital Strategy. She also served as the State Department's first chief economist. While Europe continues to express doubt about its unity, Heidi says that unity is still the linchpin of the global economy.
The European Union and the Eurozone within it is incredibly important. It's the world's biggest economy. It's our biggest trading partner. More important, it's our biggest value-driven ally. So as the U.S. is maintaining, you know, our liberal international order that we've built together with Europe since World War II. It's really having a strong, grounded Europe is an important feature for the United States.
What is the face of the European economy versus the American economy and the Chinese economy? I mean, I think of it, I'm not an economist. I think of the Chinese economy as, you know, centrally controlled. There are certain indeterminacies about China, although you generally know who to call when you want to get an answer. The U.S. economy, very market-driven, very kind of laissez-faire compared to China. Europe strikes me as a impenetrable bureaucracy.
You know, in terms of how I look at Europe right now, I really see it at an inflection point because it is deciding if it wants to stay together. So I think that that is not the case when we look at China or when we look at the United States, because the Eurozone and Europe is coming out of an economic crisis. It's coming out at multiple speeds. There are big legacy issues still to tackle from the financial crisis. They haven't really created a transfer union. So if you think about the way in the United States that we have a transfer union, we don't ask Mississippi to be New York. Mississippi isn't going to be New York, but we never question whether economically stronger states within our own union have to support weaker ones. And that's missing in Europe.
It seems to me over the last 5 years, Europe has been tested on the urgency of coming up with some sort of governance mechanism, both with the Greek crisis, secondly, with the migrant crisis, and thirdly, with but to a lesser extent, the climate crisis. What do you think is going to drive Europe to make a decision on whether it wants to stay together and come up with a governance model, or if it will just basically split apart?
So I agree with your list of challenges, and also would add the British referendum in June on whether Britain wants to stay or leave is another big issue to grapple with. I mean, does one of the largest economies and member states of Europe want to not be part of this organization anymore? They are tackling multiple challenges. They've got multiple headwinds right now. They are facing an enormous crisis with refugees and migrants, and it's testing their solidarity. It's taking up an enormous amount of political bandwidth of the leaders, and it's moving populations within countries into more extreme political positions as a backlash. So you really have the crossover of the politics and the economics, and they aren't necessarily, you know, heading in the right direction yet.
Would you say that the populist seeming drive for the so-called Brexit is an echo of the same kind of nationalism on the continent, or is it something completely different, Britain's motivations to just say to hell with you?
The Brits have been contemplating this for much longer than we've seen the significant rise in migration issues over the past year. But I would say that the migration and refugee crisis issue is very much feeding into the debate on Brexit. The Leave campaign is actually quite focused on the immigration issue. Migration more broadly, because of the demographic challenges that also face many countries in Europe, has the potential to be a positive factor as long as member countries can figure out how to integrate new migrants and refugees into their workforces. But that's going to depend on how each country can actually integrate new young populations into the labor market.
Is it the case that the weaker economies in Europe have an advantage in absorbing migrants, in that it would be a more short-term benefit for their economies than it would for a Germany or France?
It can certainly be a boost, even especially to countries like Germany, who will probably need to spend in order to come up with social infrastructure to support the new flows coming into the country. But the politics right now and the perception, particularly with countries that haven't had a history of integrating new populations, a lot of the Central and Eastern European countries, for example, have not had the same kind of history of integrating new populations. And so it can potentially be a bigger challenge.
Finally, what element of the U.S. economy is most threatened by something going on in Europe? Can you identify that, or is it just too complicated?
Well, I mean, we have huge economic interconnections. We are large investors, direct investors in each other's economies. We trade with each other. Our financial systems are completely linked. We have many, many areas where we would see real potential downturn. I guess if you were talking specifically about currencies, then a weakening euro would be as relative to a strengthening dollar. But I don't see the catastrophic scenario. I do see potential for adjustments to be made in how countries integrate.
Heidi, thanks so much.
Thank you for having me. I appreciate it.
Heidi Krubo-Redeker is Senior Fellow at the Council on Foreign Relations and CEO of International Capital Strategies. So it wasn't a buzzer beater at the end. It was a less suspenseful moment, but still a proud rout by a legendary team grabbing basketball history in a four-pack.
UConn Huskies!
The dynasty from UConn.
The national championship goes to Connecticut for the fourth year in a row as the dynasty fulfills its destiny.
Dynasty fulfills the destiny. Beth Moen had plenty of time to think of that line making the call on ESPN last night. UConn beat Syracuse 82-51. The Huskies don't fool around. Double-digit victories are their trademark. Breanna Stewart, the Huskies' star power forward, had 24 points and 10 rebounds and collected her own four-pack fourth straight year as MVP. In college basketball, nothing ever touches the record of the UCLA men's dynasties and streaks from back in the John Wooden days, but now UConn's taken all of them. Congrats, UConn. This is The Takeaway.
The Takeaway is supported by Staples, offering tools for small business, including color copies and presentations, booklets and manuals, and custom frame prints and posters. Designed and printed in-store or ordered online at staples.com. Staples, make more happen.
The 21st century has been an awakening on many levels, and we've spent much of this hour talking about that awakening, redefining the political parties in the United States. While the political movements of feminism and the breakdown of rigid gender roles are associated with cultural movements of the 20th century, there's plenty that remains in flux. British author Laura Bates discovered that in her book and social media project, Everyday Sexism, that women were experiencing daily incidents of sexism, often unmistakable evidence in language and other subtleties that gender equality remains an abstraction. A mom from Brooklyn noted to us that my daughter's father babysits her while I raise her.
This is Deb calling from Portland, Oregon, and I don't know where to begin. How about when my law school professor in my civil practice course, in which I wrote and argued a motion in a mock courtroom, offered only this as feedback, quote, "You look good dressed up," end quote. Are you kidding me?
Nothing subtle there. The language is in flux for women and men regarding gender roles. This discovery has fueled Laura Bates' Everyday Sexism project as a worldwide phenomenon. In the era of Nobel Prize-winning Malala, Laura Bates says, the power of gender roles makes this transition evident in different ways in all cultures, and it is something that apparently does not take a holiday.
I think that all forms of sexism are everyday, but I think that perhaps what was happening was that people didn't realize this was something that was occurring every day. When I tried to talk about gender inequality and sexism 4 years ago, people said to me, no, sexism doesn't exist anymore. Women are equal now. There is no problem. And so the term everyday sexism partly was born out of frustration that on the one hand, I was talking to hundreds of women and girls who were telling me about these experiences in the workplace, in the home, in education, in public spaces. And on the other hand, we had this incredible situation where the problem was completely invisible.
You referenced the sexualization of women in society and in commercial culture. What is interesting to me, though, is that women who are from teens to, in their mid-30s are having the experience of navigating this sexualized culture because it's partly an embrace, but it's also partly a vigilance and awareness. How does that balance get worked out in the stories that you've heard from so many women who've commented and become a part of this community?
Well, I think it's incredibly complex, and I think that there's such a difference between sex and sexualization. There's a difference between a woman who is choosing to enjoy her own body and a woman who is being objectified or dehumanized by someone else. There's a difference between a woman going and sunbathing on a nude beach and an advertiser deciding to use a topless woman to sell a burger that has no relation to the product. So I think that partly it's about that sense of agency and control. Who gets to control the image? Who gets to control the way that the image is interpreted? So, for example, we'll hear from young women who choose to go out wearing whatever it is that they feel comfortable and happy in. And then if they experience harassment, which we know happens to women in all different areas at all different times of day, regardless of what they're wearing, and yet they will then have that projection of other people accusing them of having asked for it, saying, you know, you shouldn't have been wearing that. So I think it's used as a weapon against women. But I think that context is just so hugely important. Because, you know, a really good example of this, I think, is that we know that women are three times more likely than men to have to take their clothes off in major Hollywood films. And we also know that women only get 28% of speaking roles in those films, and that they're only around between sort of 5 and 10% of the directors. So I don't think that there is inherently a massive problem with the idea of showing a naked woman in a film. I think that that's something that could be done in a very empowering and a feminist way. But I think when it becomes a problem is when we're only showing a woman's naked body in a film and we're not giving her any lines alongside it. We're just putting her in there as a sex object. So I feel like it's a really complex balance to strike, and it doesn't have to be about kind of saying that sex is bad or that women shouldn't be proud of their bodies or, you know, use their bodies in whatever way that they like. But it can be a red herring, I think, that we end up criticizing women. Let's look through the other end of the telescope here and recognize that 80% of 10-year-old girls in America have dieted to lose weight. From such a young age, we tell them, your body is what you are. Your body is expected to conform to an incredibly narrow, sexist, racist media ideal of what we consider the perfect body to look like. And we tell them this from such a young age that they take that in as, you know, this is what women are told that they are. And then when women grow up and care about their bodies and are proud of their bodies and worry about their bodies, we turn around and point at them and say, oh, you're the problem. What are you doing? I think obviously there's something else going on there. And I think it's about looking at the wider context rather than blaming an individual for their actions.
Who's the youngest woman who's contacted you, youngest woman or girl who's contacted you with a story that impressed you?
Well, the stories that we've heard start from, actually, one woman wrote about an experience that happened before she was even born, that she found out later on that when her mother had her first sonogram, her father's response was, oh God, they're twins and they're also both girls. Like, that was a kind of disaster. We heard the other day from the mother of a toddler who was 3 years old, and this little girl picked up a stethoscope at a playgroup, and immediately one of the other parents swooped in and said, oh, look, you're going to be a nurse, which is absolutely fine, of course, and a wonderful career. But what would they have said if it had been a little boy who'd picked up the stethoscope? So we hear from really, really young girls. And one of the things that's devastating, actually, is the number of stories that we receive from girls of, I'd say, around 11 or 12 years old who are having their first experiences of street harassment. And I think it's just, it's absolutely shocking. These girls are so young. They're in their school uniform. Often they're on their way to school and they're being shouted at in the street. They're being groped. They're being touched. They're being followed, approached. It's really a big shock to recognize just how early this is starting, I think.
This is a global movement, and you've had experiences and heard stories from people all over the world. In the era of Malala, a story which kind of just eclipses almost everything else that's happening, if you're talking about the developing world, what kinds of more typical stories are you hearing from young women in places like South Asia?
When we first started expanding internationally and women in different countries started their own branches of everyday sexism, I thought that we'd be seeing really clear kind of tropes, you know, or this is what's happening in Denmark, or this is what the stories from South Africa look like. And in reality, that hasn't really been the case. What's been really striking has been the similarities between the stories and the ubiquity, I think, of some common themes wherever you are in the world, things like blaming the victim of sexual violence, for example. But, you know, we also find, and I think this is really interesting, that one of the biggest criticisms or the biggest forms of resistance that you come up against in the United States and in the UK as well, when you try and talk about these things, is this is a problem elsewhere. You know, the really serious stuff is happening to women elsewhere. Women here are so lucky. We don't know how good we have it. And it's just so interesting, I think, that we respond in that way to something that, if it were a different kind of crisis, would be considered an epidemic. You know, so for example, the number of American troops killed in Afghanistan and Iraq between 2001 and 2012 was 6,488. And the number of American women who were murdered by current or ex-male partners during that time was 11,766. We know that three women are killed every day on average by a current or former partner in the US. We know that one in four women experiences domestic abuse. We know that hundreds of thousands of women are raped. And so we have this interesting blind spot, I think, where we want to look elsewhere and say, oh, look what women are dealing with over there. And we're not so keen to reflect on the real crisis of violence against women that we're experiencing on our own doorstep as well.
Laura Bates is founder of the Everyday Sexism Project and author of the book Everyday Sexism, out this week. Go to Facebook.com/The Takeaway to see a video from our team finding examples of everyday sexism right here in New York City's Grand Central Station. Thanks so much for listening. I'm John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.
Support for The Takeaway comes from the Henry Luce Foundation for increased understanding of East and Southeast Asia. The Takeaway's resilience reporting is supported by the Rockefeller Foundation. For more, go to rockfound.org.
PRI, Public Radio International.
I'm David Remnick, host of the New Yorker Radio Hour. There's nothing like finding a story you can really sink into that lets you tune out the noise and focus on what matters. In print or here on the podcast, the New Yorker brings you thoughtfulness and depth and even humor that you can't find anywhere else. So please join me every week for the New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.